Okay, welcome to the last lecture of the course. Hope everybody had a good time with Peter's talk and other lectures. So I want to talk about project presentations, which are next Tuesday. People who are presenting, anybody is welcome to invite other people here. It's open to everybody. People who are presenting, we're going to do it in sort of this area over here, you know, and maybe spread out a little bit, because if there's a lot of people, it would be good to have the people spread out so it's not too congested in one area versus another area. And so check out the area. There's and this room can be one area, and you can take this table and put it here or take it outside, and there's two tables and a desk out there in that corner, and those can be moved around, and you can see that there's outlets around too. So if you need to plug in, you might want to, you know, get a spot. There's nobody in this classroom before us on Tuesday, so if you can get here early to set up, that would be fine. Otherwise, we'll spend the first couple minutes getting everybody set up, and then we'll start into the presentations. For people who are presenting, it may be helpful for you, if you want, you can have, you know, note cards so that you know what to say and who's going to say it. And I would like each of the projects to send me like a three-sentence abstract, because I'm going to use the text to invite other people in an invitation. So please send me that as soon as possible. So something descriptive that would generate interest in having people here listen to what you're doing. So, you know, it's sort of like a podium presentation, but with the poster as a backdrop, sort of. So it's because you're not in this room, I still want to have a really good presentation, and it's sort of important for you to practice that. So it would be fluid, and practice the timing and make sure everybody knows what to say and how to say it. Okay, and you can bring your laptops to show videos and stuff, and certainly bring your prototype and have and be able to show that. And so there's going to be a bunch of people going around from project to project, and we're going to have scoring sheets for everybody. So everybody will be judging. So I hope that would happen, you know, just once. There'll be one group of people that does scoring, and they'll move from one project to another project. So once the people that are doing the scoring move on, then you're welcome to be a little bit more freeform with other people who are asking and be more interactive. People may be asking you questions, so want you to make sure you have good answers for them. Any questions on the presentation, the logistics? Okay, if you do have any questions, you just email me. Okay, I talked about missed lectures. For people who from the community who are going to be here Tuesday, but not next Thursday, I would like to give those people a evaluation form to fill out. Most of us are going to fill out the evaluation forms on Thursday, but if you're not going to be here on Thursday and you've attended the course, I'll give you the form on Tuesday to fill out and get back to me. It's very, very important for me to get a feel for what went right, what lectures you liked, what lectures you didn't like, what any wishes, any suggestions, comments, and stuff. This is the time to do it, and it will be an anonymous type of evaluation. So, if you're going to give it to me upside down, or fill it out in somebody else's penmanship. Okay. Last time I handed out, you know about the reports and the format for the reports. This is the format for the individual reflections. that I talked about, and I put it all together on one sheet, so there'll be no misunderstanding. And people are taking it for credit, non-credit. If you want to, you can fill it out. You can do an individual reflection as well. Masa, those are just for the students.
Can I have a seat?
Yeah. There's enough. There's enough. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay. Let's see. Here's the handout for today. Oh. Start with John. And here's the attendance sheet. Okay, we're going to continue our reminiscing of assistive technology of the past. And Dr. Rose talked about FES walking, and this is a very early slide of somebody hooked up to a FES system. And the important parts are to note that there's electrodes that are in these guys' legs, and this must be the microprocessor and stimulator that puts all the stuff together. And typically these things are controlled by the user. There's a switch there that helps him pace the system so that they can walk. It's a very old picture. This is a sort of a newer one. And I think I was actually in the room when they were doing this. I think this might have been in Washington, D.C., and they had a bunch of people doing FES walking. And this looks like Dr. Marsley, who was a VA researcher who was doing work in this field. In all these cases of FES walking, you still need to have some kind of support, whether it's canes or a walker. And basically the FES walking stimulators, you know, moved your legs. But the system wasn't stable enough or able to support your weight to do the balancing for you. So this is a very old photo of a prosthetic arm that's controlled by this joystick that's put up by the chin. And you can see how mechanical and old-fashioned it is. It's weird looking, very old. So I mean, but you know, you have to go through these steps to get, you know, to where you are. You use the technology that's available at the time, and you do the best you can. This is some work at the Cleveland FES Center, and it's hard to tell, but this woman probably does not have use of her hand for grasping, but they have an implanted stimulator with electrodes that go into the hand that enable the hand to grasp. And grasping is really important because it really provides a lot of independence. If you can grasp, then you can grab a beer can. If you can grasp, you can grab a spoon and are able to feed yourself. So those are very, that really enhances a person's independence if you're able to do that. And I think these were controlled by shrugging the shoulder. There was a joystick-type device up by the chest that allowed, you know, by moving your shoulder, you're able to control it. And I think these basically had two kinds of grasp. There's, you know, the grasp with the thumb on top and the grasp with the thumb on the side. So here's, these stimulators are FDA approved now, and they're routinely surgically implanted. I know that they've done several over here at Stanford. This is a picture of an early feeding device that's a robotic system. I'm not quite sure how this one worked or how you operated it. But, you know, typically the plate is on some type of rotary device, and then there's a a spoon that comes down, and maybe it as the plate rotates, it shovels the food into the spoon, and then the spoon is lifted to the eater's mouth. And here's a more refined version. Here, that looks pretty good. We didn't talk about this, but an environmental control system is a way for somebody who doesn't have manipulation skills to turn on and off AC powered devices and operate the TV, the an electric bed, and nurse call, and any other stuff. And this is like one of the first ones, and I remember we had these at the VA where I worked. So this box up here is an indicator. So there are several channels that it would sequence through, and you activated it by blowing or sucking into a straw. One way would advance the selection, and another way would actually, you know, activate that. So, you know, each one of these, there may be one here that would turn on the TV. There may be another one that turned on the light, and there'd be another one that turned on the fan. There'd be another one that there's actually a telephone interface that you could dial with. But this is the display device, and the actual guts of it is down here, and all these things are AC outlets. So anything you wanted to control, you had to plug it in here, even if it was across the room. So it was a little weird to do. There was also a bunch of things that relays in here that just operated switch closures, anything that you could operate by closing a switch. That's what those were for. This is actually a rotating beacon. And one of the switch closure things would be to operate a nurse call. If you've ever been in a hospital, they have a pendant switch, and you press that, and it would operate the nurse call. So that's what this was. The TV thing, let's see, how did that work? There was an on-off, and it would rotate through the channels. And when you got to the end of the list of channels, it would turn itself off. So this was the start of these types of environmental control systems. And here's one that's a little bit nicer. This one had, this is what's called an X10 device. This is a way of controlling things through the AC wiring. So this box would inject the signal into the AC wiring, which at the site where you had your lamp, you'd plug the lamp into a little adapter box and then plug both of those into the wall. And so it would command to turn on that particular light. And these are pretty commonplace and pretty rugged technology. So here's the display device, and this is a series of slot switches. And so you operate them with your hand. If you didn't have with your whole forearm, you move your forearm into those slots to control things. So that's how that worked. This is an environmental control that was actually voice operated. You would actually tell it, you know, which thing to turn on and off. And I met the guy who developed this. There are similar devices on the market. I don't think this particular one is on the market anymore, though.
I bought a real simple one before I got the remote one.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be able to say lights. Yeah. It was really quite comical. Lights, 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 lights. My sister would just laugh at me.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of that, there was actually an article on TV last night about the service dogs, and one of the things that service dogs will do is turn on lights for you and, you know, help you with activities of everyday living. So they train these service dogs for a variety of things, no, not just for blind people, but to help people, you know, pick up things off the floor or, you know, get your beer. That's could be pretty important. Okay.
They put a thing on the
Oh yeah, right.
Refrigerator,
yeah.
And then they pull the door open.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually saw a robot that would do that, and it would actually fling the beer to you. I'm sure it's on you too.
Refrigerator.
Yeah.
That if you put beer in it, like it was like you had to put the beer in the right direction. You know, you had to,
yeah.
And it would just like shoot a beer out like, at the couch.
Isn't technology wonderful? Okay, this is an early eye gaze control thing, and so the guy has this camera in front of his face. And I think this is the layout of the letters, and I'm not sure. And I'm not sure how he figures out, you know, where he is in relationship with that menu. But it's somebody else's picture. But I did see this in operation, so this is an eye gaze type thing where you look at the letters on here and there's a camera in the middle that figures out where you're looking. But you with any system like this, you have to be, your head has to be pretty still because, you know, and that's the way it worked. It had to work. So there's a lot of these early devices around, and I'm not sure how many of these that were made or used, but it's old. For a lot of things, you just need to activate a switch. So they built all sorts of switches, which can be, you know, mounted any place that you have access to, you know, with your elbow or knee or toe or whatever. Here's that slot switch, and here's some other kinds of switches. This is actually a joystick that is worn as a lavalier over your head, and you can operate things with that. Here's some other small ones. Here's, you know, four big ones in a row. And there's companies that make lots of money in just coming up with all these different switch ideas. Sort of neat. Augmented communication systems are for people who are non-vocal but have somewhat good hand control. So here's a system that this one probably uses like a magnet here and reed switches or Hall effect sensors underneath, and you just move your hand around and you dwell on a particular letter, and it would enter that letter, and it's obviously got printed out here and displayed over here. And there's a lot of devices like, you know, with this basic scheme on the market. One of the toys that really made it was this TI Speak and Spell, and so you'd enter letters here, and it would try to pronounce it. So a lot of people use this as their voice, and it was relatively inexpensive. Why wasn't it expensive? Because they made a lot of them. Anytime you make a lot of something, it gets inexpensive. But if you have a smaller market, then it's more expensive. So that's any questions about any of this stuff? Last chance. Tuesday we had our furthest speaker away coming in from Nevada, and today we have the nearest speaker. Sean Keegan is right here at Stanford. He is going to be talking about building a culture of access. He's new to Stanford, just came in the beginning of December, and he is the Associate Director of Assistive Technology in the Office of Accessible Education. And in his position, Sean oversees the implementation and support of assistive technology throughout the university. And we'll find out how well he's doing that. He's also the lead coordinator of a universal design initiative to promote the adoption of universal design principles in both learning and instruction. Sean came from the web accessibility. He was previously the web accessibility instructor and training specialist at the High Tech Center Training Unit for the California Community College System, focusing on the training and development of best practices in the areas of accessible web design, web usability, captioning of web-based media, multimedia, and the use of assistive computer technologies. So without further ado, let's bring Sean up here.
Got it? Oh, God, I hope there's no electrical storms. I'll be dead. I did keynote. Control L should take you right too. Full screen mode. And then go back. Perfect. Easy. All right. Well, thank you for having me. My name is Sean Keegan, I'm relatively new here at Stanford. Joined a few months ago. And so part of me has been learning, one, where everything's located on the campus. So when you say I'm from the nearest, I have to slightly disagree. This is a very large campus coming from one of the community colleges. I got started in accessibility about 10 years ago, and I got started in accessibility kind of in a very indirect manner. I was going to graduate school because I wanted to major in biomechanics, both clinical and sport, and the focus I had was on basically rehabilitation in terms of sports injuries as well as gait analysis, those sorts of activities. Along the way, I needed a job. Graduate school can get very expensive. And so I started working with a professor who happened to be blind. He was the director of the athletic training program. And that's when I was introduced to assistive computer technology. He used a screen reader and would basically read what was on the screen. It was pretty basic, pretty bare bones. This is, like I said, about 10 years ago. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get his assistive technologies to work better with whether it be Microsoft Windows, Word documents, the internet, just basically everything digital coming through his office. We did a lot of scanning of materials and things of that nature. And after I finished up there, I finished up my degree and was like, you know, that was fun, but this whole area of assistive technology really started to become very interesting. And I moved back out to California and struggled for a little bit trying to get a job, because who's going to hire a guy that's really interested in screen readers? You know, everything around here was about, hey, you know, the web, it's this great, wonderful place. And it's like, yeah, I know a little bit about technology. It's like, right, that's nice. Go play in the corner. We're talking about deployments here. So I got a job working in the community college system. And our focus there originally was on how do we make assistive computer technology better. So we'll be working with vendors, developers. How do we improve this assistive technology so that students, faculty, staff can gain access to these digital materials? And as Dave mentioned in the, the introduction, most of the stuff I spent doing was focused on the web. If it was up on the web in any shape or form, that was my area, and that's what I focused on. Over time, though, I came to realize that making the assistive technology better wasn't going to get us where we needed to be. And I started spending a little bit more time on access-related issues. What can we do to create an environment that really supported and integrated access so that people using assistive technologies had a very equitable experience, something similar to their peers? Okay, so regardless of your ability, disability, you'd be able to access the information and life goes on. So a real big driving question for me is, how does one begin building an environment based on access? And this is not to put assistive computer technology out of business. By no means are we going to do that. But how can we start building electronic and information technology so that it's far more functional for general population as well as individuals who may have a disability, regardless of what that disability is? Okay. So that's what I started to take a look at and I spent the last couple of years focusing on, is what can we do in terms of improving access in the electronic information technology area. Now, I would suggest we already do this in the physical space, okay? And I'm going to give the example of a curb cut, because it's probably got to be the most abused and overused example that's available out there. But we have something called the ADA Accessibility Guidelines, ADAG for short. And in there, we clearly specify, well, not so clearly, I suppose, in some respects, but we outline the location, the slope, the width, surface, obstructions, or the lack thereof, okay, for curb cut type ramps. It's fairly clear, looking in the ADAG, you can go through and say, in the physical space, this is what a curb cut should do. It's got information for diagonal style ramps and so on and so forth. Now, this is not saying that you have to make a wheelchair look a certain way or customize assistive technology a certain way, but it's focusing on the access aspect. And so this is probably the best analogy I can come up with, is this is what I was focused on, is what can we come up with our standards and guidelines to improve the access. But even when we have defined these things, we do something as silly as the following. We build a ramp right around a telephone pole to completely defeat the purpose of that ramp. Okay. It happens. I try to take pictures whenever I can of these sorts of things to kind of say, oh, yeah, that was a no-brainer. I love going into older neighborhoods. I live in an older neighborhood right now, and so you see this stuff all the time. Not very useful. So even though we have these technology standards, we still have an issue with actually implementing the correct use. But then we have a third problem. Even when we implement their correct use, we have people's behavior to contend with. Okay. So in this picture, what I've got is a perfectly usable ramp, conforms to all the necessary applicable standards and guidelines for a curb cut ramp. And we've got someone who basically parked the back half of their car in front of the ramp. It's going to make it a little tough for someone in a wheelchair, someone pushing a stroller, okay, kid trying to ride his bike, to go up and down this ramp. Okay, so people's behavior has an influence and an impact on what we do. The other reason I put this in here, while I was doing a little bit of research, I found out how people in Germany handle situations like this. There's groups of pedestrians, and I didn't know this up until recently, but there's groups of pedestrians that will go out, and when they find a situation such as the following, where a car has parked in front of a ramp of some type, they decide they have the right of way. And they will go over the top of the car, pausing ever so often to jump up and down. So the moral of the story is, one, don't park your car in front of a ramp, a curb cut, but two, if you're in Germany, don't use your car. Use somebody else's, okay? So we have situations like this. And while we can't always affect people's behavior, what we can do is make people aware of technology standards and guidelines and use these as a starting point for improving the accessibility of content and devices, okay? Oftentimes, the role that I had was dealing with developers who'd say, hey, I'd love to make it accessible. I don't even know how. Where do I even start? Okay, and they said, well, we built in captioning. This is going to really help those blind people. And we'd take a step back and go, how is captioning going to help blind people? And they'd go, oh, yeah, we're not sure. Okay, and so sometimes these technology standards and guidelines can provide some guidance and direction for actually improving the accessibility and ultimately the usability of these devices. Okay, now I'm going to focus on electronic and information technology as I go through this. And I'm going to give a couple examples in a few minutes. Two areas that I generally turn to in terms of guidelines and standards are the following. The Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which is now 2.0 format, affectionately known as WCAG. Anybody here follow web development, web accessibility, a little bit here and there? There's a group called the W3C, World Wide Web Consortium. If you ever go to their website, it's like acronym hell, okay? They've got more acronyms than they know what to do with. So the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, if it's on the web, if it's digital content-based, these are some really good guidelines to turn to. And they provide some, once again, guidance and direction about how do you build in accessibility, access to your materials. The one that I actually spend a little bit more time with, though, are the technology standards of Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And the reason I'd like to focus on this one a little bit more is because it addresses not only content, web content and such, but electronic and information technology in a much broader sense. Okay. And I'm going to give you a little definition of exactly what that means in a second. There's another reason I like to follow the Section 508 standards and provide people who are designing and developing new kinds of materials, electronic information technology materials, is because they are established standards by the Access Board that define access. Okay. For the first time, what we have within these 508 standards is something very like the ADA accessibility guidelines that defines what does it mean for to be accessible with electronic information technology, which is not something we've had for a long time. We've certainly got lots of laws that says, no, you need to ensure that there's access. You need to provide programmatic access, full participation. But what does that really mean? And the standards now carry some legal weight. The applicability of these standards is on the federal side, but there are more and more states that are now adopting it. And so as vendors are developing their technology, if they want to be able to sell to either state entities, higher education, public entities, government, federal government does a lot of business. They buy a lot of copiers, a lot of fax machines, a lot of phones, okay? A lot of computers, exactly. Just a lot of office equipment, all right? This is a carrot. They're dangling a carrot in front of the vendor saying, hey, you know what? We'll buy from you, but you need to conform to our standards. Okay. So this is what happens when a lawyer and an IT person get together in a small room together. We come up with this long, long description of what electronic information technology is. And I'm going to define it for you because it's not always as simple from the get-go as to what exactly we're talking about. So I'm just going to read this one off the top, and hopefully it doesn't put you to sleep, because if you have an insomnia problem, 508 will take care of it. Electronic information technology includes information technology and any equipment or interconnected system or subsystem of equipment that is used in the creation, conversion, or duplication of data or information. That's pretty broad. The term electronic and information technology includes, but is not limited to, telecommunications products, such as telephones. Okay? Pretty ubiquitous technology that we find in just about every major office, government or non-government. Information kiosks, transaction machines, think ATMs, worldwide websites, multimedia, and office equipment such as copiers and fax machines. This is my favorite part. The term does not include any equipment that contains embedded information technology that is used as an integral part of the product, but the principal function of which is not the acquisition, storage, manipulation, management, movement, control, display, switching, interchange, transmission, or reception of data or information. Makes perfect sense, right?
Can you give an example?
Yes. So what do we really mean from all this? It's broken down into six basic areas. Okay, we're talking about software and operating systems. We're talking about websites, web-based content, and applications that are web-based. Okay, not just plain old websites, but web-based applications. Telecommunications products. We've got video and multimedia. Okay, we've got self-contained closed products, which basically just throws a really wide net over anything that you plug into the wall and is involved in the creation, conversion, and duplication of content. Okay, fax machines, what's that?
Photocopiers,
you know, things of that nature. Telephones sometimes fall into this, as well as telecommunication devices. So a product can fall into multiple areas at the same time. And of course, last but not least, desktop and portable computers. So the idea here is that these technology standards have been established to say, this is what access means now. All right? You can come up with your own way of doing it, but we're going to hold you to these standards when we now talk about building access into the product. And this is what the standard looks like. This is just a snapshot from one of the standards. And it's actually broken up this way where you've got basically a three-column layout, where on the left column you've got the actual access criteria. The middle column is an opportunity for someone to actually say, yes, this is how I conform or do not conform to that specific checkpoint. And then people can put in some remarks or explanations. So anybody here use the web browser Firefox? Okay, so we got about half the room. Okay. So the criteria, this is actually a set of checkpoints from the Firefox evaluation of their product, because they want to conform. And even though they're not selling something, they still are trying to demonstrate how they conform and provide for in a very accessible browser environment. Okay, so it's a software application that we're talking about here. And one of the criteria under the software standards will read something like this. When the software is designed to run on a system that has a keyboard, think computer, the product functions shall be executable from a keyboard where the function itself or the result of performing a function can be discerned textually. Makes perfect sense, right? We all know what we need to do now if we're going to go out and develop our own web browser platform. The short version of this is the following. If you're creating an application, let me back it up, I'll say it this way. In the upper left corner of the Firefox web browser, whether it's on a Mac or Windows, I don't care either, in the upper left corner of the web browser, there's a set of menu options. The file drop-down menu, you'll see it up there, okay? That can be discerned textually. It's text-based, all right? And the intent of this is saying, well, if you've got a system that has a keyboard, then you should be able to access that file menu system from the keyboard. That's the interpretation. Okay, great. Pretty simple. Makes perfect sense. Okay. And so the intent of this is to say, look, if you've got product functions where I can discern text on the screen, you should be able to operate those from the keyboard and not rely exclusively on the mouse. Because that would be an input issue. For someone who cannot use a mouse, they've got to deal with the keyboard, i.e., someone who's blind. Someone who's blind, fully blind, does not rely on the mouse to interact with their content. They can use the keyboard. So what they're trying to program in here in these standards is say, look, use whatever you want, but at least allow for support through the keyboard as a method of input. And then Firefox has its comments where it supports it. Keyboard equivalents are provided for all actions. And then it goes on and talks a little bit more in detail about how that's achieved or not achieved. In this case, Firefox supports all standard keyboard entry, but it does say, hey, if someone installs Java or Flash, that's something else that I can't handle on the website. Okay. So it breaks down the criteria and then provides support for it. So we're defining access in some respects. And we're not saying this is going to solve everyone's problem, but it's a starting point to say we can address some issues. So, quick pop quiz. Yeah, electronic information technology. Web pages covered? Okay, do this. Up and down. Yes. All right, there we go. Microsoft Windows, OS X, Linux. Would that be covered? Development of operating systems. All right. Fax machines and copiers. All right. Heating ventilation systems.
No information. What's that?
Not conveying information. Now, what happens if that heating ventilation system had a whole web-based interaction system? Would it be covered then? Okay. Heating ventilation system itself wouldn't, but the web component of that heating ventilation system would. Okay.
The interface to control it.
So there's subtleties in here, and the intent of that was to kind of help limit a little bit and say, look, for those of you developing heating ventilation systems, don't worry about this stuff. We're not going to even bother. If you want to, go right ahead. But we're not going to assess this stuff because some of this stuff can't always be addressed. Coffee makers, would those be covered? Coffee makers wouldn't, unless it sends an email. Okay. Okay. Back in the day, who was it? Who had the coffee pot that set up with the webcam? MIT, yeah. One of the first webcams ever online. The engineers got sick and tired of walking up to the second floor only to find out the coffee pot was empty. So they hooked up a little webcam to do it. So they could say, oh yeah, the coffee pot's full. Now I'm going to go up. That was the other thing. Nobody ever wanted to clean out the coffee pot. So coffee machines don't count unless they send you an email when either the coffee's empty or the coffee's full. Okay. So electronic information technology is defined fairly specifically. Yeah. Oops. That's not. Nope. That's not. Now, once again, this was simply telling vendors, look, if you guys want to do this, these are the standards that we're defining as access. But in terms of being considered electronic and information technology, the conversion, creation, duplication of content or information, that falls outside of that. The coffee pot in of itself uses information technology, but in terms of the user experience with it, no. And there's some gray areas. I'm going to be talking about that at the very end. There's some gray areas in, where the technology standards start to fail a little bit.
Okay.
Couple things that I experienced that I've had. One of them was with an ATM machine. And this goes back several years. I was at a conference and sitting behind a couple of gentlemen and they were talking, and one of them said, "Wow, this is an amazing conference. You know, did you notice they had Braille on the ATM machine?" And the gentleman, the counterpart next to him, said, happened to be blind, said, "Yeah, that's really useful if you can read the screen." Okay, and the intent was, "Wow, look, we've made this device, and we've completely skipped a whole step here." Okay, it kind of goes back to that whole, "Hey, we made captioning for those blind people." Like, what were you thinking? Okay, so a couple things that are very normal with an ATM machine we've got that we need to know in order to interact with it. We need to know the orientation of the card, our ATM card. Okay, now where it is on the screen, you can generally feel where the card slot is, and it's usually located fairly close to where the keypad or the display screen is located at. Okay, but how do you insert the card? Okay, what's the orientation? Because they're different from different ATMs. Oftentimes, you have a time limit for the transaction. If it doesn't receive any input, okay, are you thinking? Have you left? What are you doing? So there needs to be some method to control timing. Obviously, to enter in the numbers or to actually do something with the ATM, you need to be able to tactically discern what the buttons are and what the other buttons are on the screen, because usually the screens have two rows of buttons on both sides of the screen. What button are you supposed to push for $20 versus $120? Okay, so you need to be able to tactically discern where those things are and be able to push the buttons. And then you have an on-screen menu that requires some type of response. It's going to ask you for something, and you have to do something if you want your money. Okay, so an ATM machine has a number of different types of user experiences. And taking a look at this, there's a number of checkpoints that would apply. ATM would be a self-contained closed product. And so when speaking with developers, one of the things that we do is say, okay, what is your product that you're looking at? Now let's take a look and see which of these standards would apply to the product you're developing. So rather than me going and testing every little one thing, I can say, look, work on this part and then come back and we'll talk. Because this, you'll be headed down the right path if you can meet some of these standards, or more, ideally all of them. So I'm going to just a couple of these things that I pulled out with respect to self-contained closed products. The first one's actually pretty much kills everybody right then and there. Self-contained products shall be usable by people with disabilities without requiring an end user to attach assistive technology to the product, which pretty much seals the fate of most of the products by saying, you know what, get up your butt and design something that's functional to a wider audience. Okay, and then it goes on to say that it talks about timed responses. If you're going to have a timed response, people need to be able to either ask for more time if necessary. You should be able to feel the controls and keys. Controls and keys should be operable with one hand. No pushing, pulling, twisting motions. Keep that one in mind. That one's going to come up a little bit later from now. If you're going to have audio output, then make sure that your audio output conforms to industry standards. Okay? And most of the industry is settled on either a 2.5 millimeter or 3.5 millimeter audio jack. Okay, so somebody with their, you know, $399 set of earbuds can go and plug in and listen to what the information says. Because the general model of an ATM machine that shouts out how much you're taking out is probably not a really good model for an ATM machine, particularly in a crowded spot. But these are things people do. They put, like, oh, we need to have voice. Okay, or audio output. We're going to put a speaker. It's like, hello? So I ran into this picture a while ago. And like I said, I kind of harvest some of these. And this was one of the first ATM machines that I saw that actually came, and right smack in the dab, there is a port for your audio jack. Okay, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. I haven't actually tried it yet, so I don't know what it actually says to you. I mean, you could, you know, for all intents and purposes, you might plug in, it might say, hi, you're going to need sighted assistance in order to use this terminal. Thank you for coming. You know, I don't know. That would really, that would be a really cruel design and development joke. The opposite of an Easter egg. But what we had here, and what I was interested about this, was the keypad buttons were actually fairly large. Okay. And not every key needed to be labeled. Most of the time, they'll label one specific key, particularly on a phone type of keypad, the five keys labeled. You can find your orientation to the rest. The keys on the right, there's a big X for the cancel key. There is an O for the confirm key, for the enter key. And they did some type of like up and down slash for the, or a horizontal slash for the yellow key. I have no idea what that one actually did. But then you actually had the keys on the right side. They were very discernible. And they were a little bit bigger than normal. And what I thought was really interesting about this was, one, it definitely addressed access issues. So someone with a disability, happened to be blind, okay, or perhaps had a mobility impairment, could actually use this interface. But what I thought was really interesting, after spending some time in the Midwest, where it gets really, really, really cold, and people don't like to get out of their cars, okay, what they also don't like to do is take off their gloves. Okay. Anybody ever tried to use an ATM machine with really close buttons with big gloves on? Yeah, you have. You're from Canada, yeah. It gets a little awkward. And suddenly you're extracting a whole lot more money out of your ATM account, or a whole lot less than you planned to. So the intent behind this, from some of these technology standards, and I did some follow-up with this with some of the ATMs out there, they are publicly saying, yeah, look at the standards we're conforming to now. We're following the 508 standards by our product. Even though they may not be selling to the federal government, to the general public, they're trying to say, look how much more we're doing to improve the accessibility of our product. And I think that translates into some general usability principles as well. Another one that came up, and actually, self-contained closed products, you can read that some of these checkpoints are in there. What I want to talk about is, this is actually a copy machine in our office, and I was really interested because it was one of the first copy machines that I've seen in a very long time, okay, printer copier, I should say, that has some accessibility features built in. And I did a little research online. It turns out it's made by Konica Minolta. They happen to be a huge seller to the government. And they have a very nice documentation, their template. It's called a VPAT, Voluntary Product Accessibility Template. And so their template fills out exactly how they conform or they don't conform to these technology standards. And one of the criteria happens to be from the vertical plane. So from the vertical plane, okay, the keypad, the interaction experience, has to be between 15 and 54 inches off the ground, okay, if the interaction control or the display happens to be within 10 inches of the vertical plane. So, got a vertical plane. If it's within 10 inches, it can be between 15 and 54 inches off the ground. Okay. We're defining what access means. Is it going to solve everyone's problem? Nope. But it's going to certainly address a number of issues. And over here, if you've got a vertical, from the vertical plane, if it's more than 10, but has to be less than 24 inches, it's allowed to be 15 to 46 inches to allow, generally speaking, the average reach for someone who's seated in a wheelchair. Okay? So, that's what the standard says. And what we have in our office is something that is actually, I did a quick measurement, it's about 41 inches off the ground. So this panel right here happens to be about 41 inches off the ground. So it falls within that requirement. From the vertical plane, it's less than 10 inches. A, everything's really nice. What they also have done, though, is they've built in the flexibility so that the front panel folds. Okay? The intent of 508 was not to say, you have to conform to this standard and this standard only. You can't innovate. And what this vendor did is say, well, wait a minute. If it's flat out, okay, if my control panel is completely horizontal, how is someone actually going to be able to see what the display has to say on it? And so they've got a real simple mechanism whereby just doesn't require very much. It allows it to drop down and you can into more of an angled position. Okay, it's not required in the standards, That's kind of a nice feature. Does it solve all problems? No, it doesn't. And in this case, one of the things that actually from a colleague in the office suggested, wouldn't it be really nice if perhaps in addition to dropping down, this interface could actually maybe slide out as well? So the standard only requires someone to come up in a side position, okay, to work from a to work alongside in a parallel position to the copy machine. Well, in our office, we happen to have a little bit of a wall there, not to mention if someone's in a larger power chair, it might be easier to come straight into the copy machine. Okay. The other thing you could think about, if someone perhaps has weak back muscles, it's one thing to lean forward, a little bit harder to get back. So if you had a system that not only pivoted, but also could extend, now you've really improved the usability of that system. Yes, it meets the technical standard for accessibility, but now we've really improved the actual usability by an individual who may have a disability. Okay? So the technical standards are there to kind of help give us a head start and some guidance, and then we can do some product innovation from there. This came up in terms of some of the innovation, some of the benefits, a little bit when I was dealing on a web project with a learning management system company. And the learning management system company came and said, okay, we hear that you now have some technical standards for accessibility. We said, yeah, we do. And they said, all right, fine. We want to make sure our product works with JAWS. Can you test it and let us know? It's like, oh boy, here we go again. JAWS is one of the more popular screen readers out on the market for individuals who are blind and visually impaired. And our comment back to them was, you know, that's nice, but we've got some access issues. We don't want to simply be making products that work with a specific piece of assistive technology. It needs to be a little bit more ubiquitous, a little bit broader. And so we sent them some checkpoints. We said, look, for what you're looking for a specific part of your product, and I'll show you what it looks like, these are some of the checkpoints that you need to be addressing. Okay? And the big one here was a text equivalent for every non-text element shall be provided. In other words, if you're going to put a picture on your web page, there better be a text equivalent for it. Okay? Some kind of text behind the scenes. Anybody know why text becomes really important in digital environment? This is where I say, how does assistive computer technology like Google? Anybody know? They both love text. I mean, that's for the most part what Google eats, text. Assistive technology, if you can have it in a text-based environment, it's happiest, okay? Get these pictures and all these other things, it's like, eh. But if there's a text basis for it, it's very, very happy. And so what we had was basically the original design of this was a series of buttons down here on the left side, a menu bar, a menu navigation scheme, as well as across the top. And it was all done with pictures. They're all JPEGs. So we said, okay, fine, this is really, really simple. Go into the code, and this is what you'd enter. So, for instance, under course content, okay, they had this nice graphic with a picture of text that said course content. And we said, that's simple. Go into the code and type this in. And the developer groaned because they had a lot of pictures. It wasn't simply just a find and replace. They had a lot of pictures. So they went back to the development team, and they did their work. And ultimately, the product came out looking like this. And this is actually what you see in this nav bar, this vertical navigation bar here. Course content, announcements, assessments, assignments, that's actually text content. It's actually text that's been styled to look pretty. Okay? Common web technology that's used there. It makes it look pretty. And I ran into the developer that was the project manager on this a while back. And I said, you know, how did that go? I mean, what was the response from your development team? What did they think? We gave you the standards. We told you what we needed to do. From our side, we were happy. But how'd things go internally? And he goes, oh, yeah, they totally groaned and you know, complained about it. And he said, but that only was for a couple of days. Very, very quickly, one of them came back from the marketing group, and they said, wow, that was the best thing that we ever could have done. And it turned out the whole other part of the company was trying to push the product into new markets in the foreign sector. And once this information here was text-based, okay, with some simple styling, it made it really, 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 really easy to push it out into basically non-English languages. Okay. He came back, he said, yeah, it's probably saved us about 3 or 4 months of development time. We would have had to gone back and recreate new pictures for every single deployment we wanted to do for in the foreign markets. And this way we just can change some real basic content and get it pushed right back out. It's far simpler. So I said, great, you know, how about you pay us that money that you guys saved for that great insight, you know? And they said, no, that was never going to happen. So, no, they didn't even buy us lunch. The downsides of conference calls. So the idea behind this was that we started with some technical standards, and we actually ended up with something that was very, very useful. Okay. So some emerging areas, something that I just want to point out really quickly. Now, I know we've had the conversation with a couple weeks ago, TV Raman was here, talked about the G1 phone, which is in the lower left corner here. And one of the things that we're really focusing on in accessibility that's really, I mean, it's happening outside of accessibility as well, but from an access environment, how are we going to be dealing with the mobile platform? Is it going to require just a software solution? Is it going to require a hardware-software solution? What's going to be the best solution that's going to give people an access platform by which assistive computer technologies can be layered into this process? Okay. We've seen the demos that that the G1 is now being is supporting. What I thought was really interesting, I ran across this mock-up of how perhaps a combination hardware-software solution could be used on the iPhone. And basically, this is kind of like a cover that would go over the iPhone. And what you can see is basically it's in boss relief, where the person can actually tactically discern the different elements on the screen. And by using this cover, you'd have an underlying change in the software as well. Okay. Now, I don't know if Apple's going to be really all that happy with you hacking away at their iPhone kernel and changing everything. Maybe they would be. But the fact now there's a software development kit out, I see some of the possibilities of this being actually happening. Does it still give you full, complete access to the phone? That would be a great question. I don't know. But from a conceptual standpoint, it was a really interesting way to go. The other part I see with this that I don't think people have even scratched yet is in the exercise environment. I happened to be at a gym a couple of weeks ago, and they had installed all these new exercise machines, and they all now come with touch panels. You can watch TV, you can watch movies, you can press buttons on the touch panel. Okay, completely inaccessible. Okay, relatively low maintenance, but completely inaccessible. That being said, it wouldn't be too far of a stretch to say, hey, how can we have a simple membrane that could go over the front of this touch screen that maybe someone checks out, and then by pushing a certain button, it completely changes the underlying screen so that it conforms to this new, you know, something like a membrane or some type of overlay. Okay. Potentials are in there. The one that I'm actually really interested in, too, is the gestural and spatial systems. And I've got a quick video. It's about 2 minutes long. You got it? Okay. And the reason it's a new company that's come out within the last few months. And some of the people that are working on this product come out of the MIT Media Lab, which always has some really, really cool stuff. So I'm going to just let this go. I'll narrate a little bit, or we'll have the audio. So we'll let us go for about a minute or two. But it's some really interesting things, and I'm going to finish up with what are some of the accessibility issues and also some accessibility potentials here in a second. Watch how the hands have to move. So basically, using your hands, you can navigate these multi-screen displays. zoom, rotate, draw on the screen, zoom out, or move things down to a tablet in front of you to manipulate. I thought that was really cool. The collaboration option, I think, raises some really interesting potential as well. So I'm just going to kill that right there because it goes on for another 90 seconds or 2 minutes. So the video is at oblong.com. And the reason I'm interested in this is because while a lot of these technologies are not commonplace, they're not that ubiquitous type of technology that we're dealing with now, then again, neither were cell phones. And some of these technology standards that we're looking at now may seem to be a bit archaic, but my argument is that they still provide a fundamental level of access. And as we start developing some of these new gestural and spatial environments, if we still have a base solution for general access, okay, we can start building that environment where an individual can interact with their assistive technology with the products without requiring a Rube Goldberg type of approach to actually getting something to work. And the one thing that keeps coming up with some of these spatial environments is, obviously, I think hand control becomes an issue, pinching, grasping, twisting of the wrist, okay? But one thing that I'd be really interested to see what happens is fatigue. How would someone with a mobility impairment who is able to have some upper limb functionality be able to handle some of the mobility issues that are required in terms of fatigue? Minority Report.
Apparently,
right.
Apparently, they had to take long breaks when he was doing all of that stuff because he was being fatigued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of potential here, a tremendous amount of potential. What I look at the standards as providing is some guidance and direction to make sure that we don't jump in our eagerness to say, wow, look how this great new technology works. We still build in some functional backups, so to speak, that allow for that seamless integration of an individual's own personal assistive technology into the broader electronic information technology architecture. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Any questions for Sean?
That was easy.
While you're taking that, for working on projects, I got some report binders for you to use. So I got, let's see, Hannah Montana, Spider-Man, Mickey Mouse, Goofy. Now they're all the same.